Okay, and my email is klogan.md@yahoo.com. klogan.md@yahoo.com. Let me know if there's a subject you'd like me to cover cover on this show. The opinions voiced on this show do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. The Doctor's Inn is made possible by you, the listeners, and your generous contributions, and by Friends of the Arts, a state local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts has been creating economic opportunity through arts and culture by producing community festival and events, including, and this is a long list, I'm sitting down, Artoberfest, Chico Paleo, the True North Tour, the Silent Film Festival, the NorCal Jazz Festival, the Salmon Festival, and more. To learn about Friends of the Arts, visit friendsoftheartsupstate.org. And by the Chico News and Review, providing Northern California with news, commentary, and entertainment. The Chico News and Review is available for free every Thursday at over 600 locations throughout Butte, Glynn, and Tehama counties. They can also be found online at newsreview.com. Today's show is going to be about the dignity of dying, or dying with dignity. And I was thinking about this on the drive over here, that we all know that life includes not only the living, that is being born and living the life that you have for however long you have to live, and then finally death, or not being alive anymore. And different parts of the world, different cultures, including our culture, we all view death in different ways, and different ways of approaching how we handle that as family members and as individuals. So it's a subject that that we're going to discuss today. And we are fortunate to have with us today Reverend Chaplain Mary Kearns, who is an ordained minister and board-certified chaplain with the Association of Professional Chaplains. She moved to Chico 9 years ago with her husband, Jesse, and their three sons. Mary's worked in hospitals, hospices, and palliative care settings, where she applied her training in bioethics to help families and individuals make informed choices about their end-of-life care. Currently, at Shalom Free Clinic and her church, which is the First Christian Church of Chico, she does host bereavement groups, which offer emotional and spiritual and educational support to individuals whose loved ones have died. Currently, she's working on her Death and Grief Studies certification with the Center for Loss and Life Transition in Fort Collins, Colorado. So nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Tell us, inform us, give us the gestalt of this subject.
All right. Well, I think before we discuss the Death with Dignity Law, also known as the California End of Life Option Act Law, we need to understand the history of why this law even came into existence.
So let me just butt in here real briefly. So we're talking about death with dignity, mm-hmm. and the dying process in we humans. Mm-hmm. And so right off the bat, we're going to talk, Mary's telling us about a law, mm-hmm. actually, that passed here in the state of California recently, mm-hmm. relative to this fact. Okay, thanks, Mary.
So why this law came into existence, it actually goes back to 1975, and the first patient case was Karen Ann Quinlan. And many of us old folks remember that case.
I remember that name.
She lapsed into a coma, and then she remained in a persistent vegetative state from which she never recovered. Well, her parents realized that she was never going to recover, and so they wanted to remove her off the respirator. And the
and this was after how many years? Or so? I mean, this was a long time. Yeah. She was in a vegetative state on a respirator.
There were several years. And the hospital and the doctor said, no, we're not going to do that. That's homicide. And so the family took it to the courts. And the first time around, it was ruled against them. They said, no, she has to continue getting treatment. And then they took it to the New Jersey Supreme Court, and then there they said, no, we're going to rule in the family's favor. And there were some medical ethics and some rights that involved influenced that. But this case served as the genesis for bioethics and ethics committees in hospitals. What Karen Ann Quinlan's case taught us was that the goal of medicine should not merely be to have an effect, but to cure. To have an effect that benefits that can be appreciated by the patient. If medicine or medical practice can no longer cure, then patients and doctors need to enter into conversations that discuss burdens and benefits of continued treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So while there are several medical ethics that are utilized, go on Google, you'll find many, many, many.
Mm-hmm.
The four main ethical principles that impact end-of-life care are autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and futility. And so I have some definitions of what these are. You can interrupt as you want to go along. So autonomy, people have the right to control what happens to their bodies. This principle simply means that an informed, competent adult patient can refuse or accept treatments, drugs, and surgeries according to their wishes. People have the right to control what happens to their bodies because they are free and rational, or what we say, alert and oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And these decisions must be respected by everyone, even if those decisions aren't in the best interest of the patient. Mm-hmm. There are times
for the best interest of the patient's medical life or life, medical situation or life.
That's
it's
right.
Their decision, and they are an individual and they are autonomous.
I think of people who say, no more chemo. I'm done.
No more chemotherapy. Uh-huh.
No more chemotherapy. I'm done. I'm tired of barfing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tired of all this. I just, no more.
Mm-hmm.
People have the right to say no more to this treatment.
Sure.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah. So the next ethic that we deal with is called beneficence. All healthcare providers must strive to improve their patient's health, to do the most good for the patient in every situation, which is what the doctors thought in the Karen Ann Quinlan case. But what is good for one patient may not be good for another. So each situation should be considered individually.
Mm-hmm.
It's a case by case by case by case.
Mm-hmm.
And other values that might conflict with beneficence may need to be considered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, different cultures have different ways of handling these end-of-life decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to honor where each individual and family and culture and spirituality, which, you know, people use to help themselves get better.
Like you say, I mean, and that definitely, that just says again, the individual case by case by case by case situations are, everyone's different.
Yeah. The next one, the next ethic is called non-maleficence. And if you can spell that, I'll give you a Snickers bar.
I can't even say the word, much less figure out how to spell it.
It literally means first, do no harm.
Oh, okay.
And that is the bedrock of medical ethics.
Mm-hmm.
In every situation, healthcare providers should avoid causing harm to their patients. You should also, though, be aware of the doctrine of double effect, where a treatment intended for good unintentionally causes harm.
Really?
Yeah, when they did CPR on my 84-year-old grandfather and broke 7 ribs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a double effect when continuing to do aggressive medical treatment ends up hurting your patient more than healing them.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to echo that word again, first do no harm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this doctrine helps you make difficult decisions about whether actions with double effects can be undertaken.
Mm-hmm.
So these are some of the things that doctors are thinking about with their patient care, with each individual, if a patient's in the ICU, and they can't cure this patient. So now they have to start weighing, well, all this treatment, is this is this pain-free? Is this going to help? Is this hurting this person in the long run?
Mm-hmm.
And not many people, unless you're medical, have an understanding of what a long-term ICU mm-hmm. stay looks like, what it does to the body, and they don't understand how pushing fluids when someone's in kidney failure is not a good thing to do, or keeping a ventilator mask on old people whose skin is so thin, it literally debrides their skin.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many things that I've seen as a chaplain and a hospice chaplain mm-hmm. that, you know, they're in the hospital, they're supposed to get better. Well, you know, sometimes the disease has gone further than we can cure.
Mm-hmm.
So that's non-maleficence. And then finally, and this is kind of a real hot ethic, a real hot topic, and that's futility.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to hear that word. No one wants to hear that word. But futility is a clinical circumstance in which it is concluded that further treatment cannot cure the underlying disease process or improve or restore quality of life to the patient's satisfaction. The goal of medicine is not merely to provide an effect, but a benefit which can be appreciated by the patient. Therefore, a treatment is futile if a patient remains in a persistent vegetative state without conscientious autonomy, Kiernan, mm-hmm. Quinlan, or other folks that we know, or a patient remains confined to the ICU and is therefore preoccupied with treatment and cannot achieve any life goals. So those are the big four ethics that I feel go on the most in end-of-life decision-making and end-of-life care. And these are the things that doctors are thinking and social workers and chaplains and families. And families aren't really aware of these things.
Yeah.
But those are the principles that are guiding the decision-making process. And these principles are also, I think, why palliative care came into being. It was doctors who were recognizing that other doctors were treating aggressively or acutely, as we say, right to the very end, and then saying, oh, well, can't do anything more. Here's hospice. And the person's in hospice for like 2 hours, 2 days. When if they had backed off of this aggressive treatment
earlier
and allowed the individuals to, manage their pain, focused on quality of life, comfort care. These are the things that...
For palliative.
Yeah, for palliative.
Mm-hmm.
People reported having feelings of this was a dignified death. The family were like, we had more time to prepare.
Mm-hmm.
There was more time to say goodbye. There was mm-hmm. more time to reflect. There was more time to get right with each other. I mean, mm-hmm. these things, understanding that, okay, if we can't get a cure, can we, you know, keep mom and dad or grandma and grandpa or husband, you know, free of pain, but in a place where they're not suffering and we have time.
You have time to spend time with them, and
right.
they have time to spend with you.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Before a more sudden demise.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Because I think one of the things that's really hard to get our heads wrapped around is I often think folks get their idea of medicine from TV.
Yeah.
They think everything's ER. And that's
ER on TV.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and though that is so skewed, you mm-hmm. know, they portrayed a 76% success rate of CPR.
CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, you know,
right.
where we try to bring mm-hmm. somebody back whose heart has stopped.
Right.
75, they portray a 75%
right.
Success rate.
Yeah.
You and I know that isn't true.
That's not true.
That's way skewed.
Yeah. With younger patients, it's less than 15%.
Mm-hmm.
And then past 75, it's less than 3.
Mm.
And so what happens is, you know, the risks of resuscitation, people may survive the resuscitation, but they don't know the long-term complications that come after that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I ran into as a chaplain with families is they think loving mom and dad, loving grandma and grandpa, loving my husband or wife means do everything. You know, keep pushing all that aggressive medical treatment, thinking mm-hmm. that that's going to bring the cure, you know, but when you're in that state, there's also some good denial in place
mm-hmm.
that's sheltering you from a whole lot of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But the medical community, you know, looks at these case by case.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the realization that we can't do any more good,
mm-hmm.
we can't get ahead of this systemic failure, you know, the mm-hmm. system's failure. So you start broaching that subject with the family and mm-hmm. with the individuals.
which takes time and understanding and patience.
And gentleness.
And
empathy. Helping
passion.
People. Oh, for us, it was like helping them get their heads wrapped around it. I mean, it's traumatic enough when a loved one falls down, you know, and mm-hmm. has a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
That just rocks your world.
Mm-hmm.
But then, so they survive the initial event. They survive the resuscitation, but they're in the ICU, mm-hmm. and life is getting smaller, and chances are getting slimmer. And mm-hmm. and you know, and as a chaplain, I have folks who are like, God's going to heal my loved one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm like, I'm never one to discount a miracle, and I have seen some miracles, Ken,
mm-hmm.
I really have.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also seen people not looking at the reality of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I had to explain to them was that, you know, turning off the machines is not causing death. The underlying condition and the disease process is what's causing death.
Mm-hmm.
And in chaplain speak, we call it AND, allow natural death.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of my brothers and sisters in the whole Christian spectrum, you know, there are some who are they're really against this. They're just like, no, you're playing God, you know.
Mm.
And my response to that is, well, I think you kind of played God when you turned the machine on in the first place.
Exactly.
You know, they wouldn't have survived.
Good point.
Yeah, they wouldn't have survived that event. And so, but each situation has to be worked out, you know, with a person's autonomy, with their faith, with their family, with their culture. Each situation has to be weighed. And, you know, if you're going to end up in that situation, hopefully you have your advanced directive done.
Yeah, advanced directive paperwork
mm-hmm.
in your life, done in your life, laid out prior to any problems occurring medically in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Advanced directive, which includes a person's decisions that they may have
mm-hmm.
and desires relative to end-of-life care,
mm-hmm.
and specifically, which would include specifically the cardiopulmonary resuscitation or not.
Right.
Yeah, advanced directives, good thing to have lined up for all of us ahead of while we are healthy, along with our will and our other things,
mm-hmm.
whatever that paperwork is, we call it, you know,
mm-hmm.
estate planning or whatever. Advanced directives as part of that is a good idea.
Yeah. So ethics, you know, ethics are fine in theory, but once
mm-hmm,
you have
mm-hmm.
to start putting them into practice,
mm-hmm.
I mean, well, you can know what the ethic is, but when you get into the middle of it, it can be excruciating
mm-hmm.
because these are people and
mm-hmm.
these are people's lives that we're talking
mm-hmm.
about. And you, as a chaplain, I companion these people and I co-journey with them, and their angst becomes my angst, and I share that with them. And so I know how life-changing these situations can
oh, yeah.
be. So that's why it is you really just have to do a case by case. But you know, back to the California End of Life Option Act law. Right now in California, it is legal for a terminally ill patient to request a drug from his or her physician that will end their life. Patients who choose to end their lives this way and who carefully follow the steps in the law will not be considered to have committed suicide.
Can you say that paragraph again? Repeat that again.
It is now legal for It is now legal for a terminally ill patient to request a drug from his or her physician that will end the patient's life. Patients who choose to end their lives this way and who carefully follow the steps in the law will not be considered to have committed suicide. Physicians who help their patients with this process and who carefully follow the steps of the law will be providing a new legal form of end-of-life care and will not be subject to legal liability or professional sanction for doing so. This option is voluntary for both patients and physicians. So it's a law
in the state of California.
But it's where are you going to get it done? Where does it happen? And
so it's a relatively new law, and so mm-hmm. the implementation or the mm-hmm. us seeing this in law in action mm-hmm. has not had much time yet.
Right. I know locally, Feather River has already come up with a statement.
Feather River Hospital.
Yeah, in Paradise, uh-huh. Where I volunteer at as a chaplain. And Adventist Health and Feather River Hospital are opting out of the California End-of-Life Option Act as allowed by requirements set forth in the law.
So the law allows the hospital to opt out of mm-hmm. participating in end-of-life mm-hmm. In this way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This law goes against their mission mm-hmm. and their code of ethics, and mm-hmm. they're like, nope, we're not going to do it. We don't mm-hmm. have to. I know some of other hospitals in area, Reading, Mercy, with the Catholic mm-hmm. Hospital or Dignity Health, I'm pretty sure they probably won't mm-hmm. do that either. And mm-hmm. so then it becomes, all right, so it may be a law, but where can it be provided at? And mm-hmm.
The law says that the hospital doesn't have to do that, mm-hmm. or a physician doesn't have to do
right.
that, participate with a patient that in end of life. However, they are able to do it legally if they mm-hmm. choose to.
That's right.
Okay, I gotcha.
And so I think people are going to have to make decisions. You know, doctors, mm-hmm. man, I wouldn't want to be in your shoes
yeah.
if someone came to you and said, I have terminal cancer. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go through the end stages of this. I want to end my life. Can you help me? I don't know how I would handle that. I don't know how you would handle that.
Yeah. Make that happen, yeah. I know you and I were talking about it briefly before the show, and, I think, am I correct, we were not able to know from the law at this point yet whether there was any stipulation that end-of-life process had to happen in a facility such as a hospital or not. Did we determine that from our reading?
I wasn't sure. My initial readings is that the patient has to be declared terminally ill.
Yeah.
Now, we know that terminally ill normally is what I call like a hospice diagnosis, 6 months or less.
Mm-hmm.
We do know sometimes doctors have been wrong about that. Mm-hmm. Patients have lived much longer than 6 months.
Yeah, and whether or not it has to be, you know, these are questions maybe you and I can look into the law a little more after, but a quick into my head question is does it have to be specifically determined by one physician, or does it have to be two licensed physicians mm-hmm. that agree upon that terminology of terminally ill?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what about this 6 month question mark, which is always a guess anyway?
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of that terminally ill terminology?
Mm-hmm.
Makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I can understand people who are, and I say this truthfully because I've seen this happen, in a state it's called terminal agitation, or what I call berserk with pain.
Hmm.
They have a condition where existence is pain.
Mm-hmm.
And they're screaming,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they want relief. Mm-hmm. And so there you get that double effect where to medicate them to the point where they're not having any pain is also helping them to pass away peacefully.
Mm-hmm.
And so as advocates for this law have said, haven't we already mm-hmm. been doing this? But it's been in a hospital, and it's been, you know, in these different cases. And so that was...
Let me answer that question for you. The answer is yes, we have been doing this.
Mm-hmm. I have seen dozens of that, and it's just when the disease process has gotten to the point where no medicine is going to relieve this person from their pain, and it becomes relieve them of their pain, help them to sleep, help mm-hmm. them to, to go to sleep.
Yeah. In trying to help the patient at the end of their life
mm-hmm.
be more comfortable.
Yeah.
It's a good idea, generally, I would think.
It is. So, but there are people who are really against this law, too.
Mm-hmm.
There's pros and cons to it. The ARC, they brought some real serious concerns. Little People of America, they have some different groups out there. One of them is called Not Dead Yet, which I thought was a real interesting thing to name their site. But they are activists that oppose assisted suicide, and they say it's a deadly form of discrimination.
Hmm.
They think, you know, for them it's, well, back up. For people who say, I don't want to get to the point where I don't have autonomy or my family's taking care of me or I have loss of control, these are all things that people with acute disabilities have to deal with every day. But they have full and wonderful lives and they want to be able to live their life and get the support from their community. So they're not looking at it as a positive. They're looking at it as someone's going to look at them and go, well, why aren't you opting out? And that's kind of scary to me.
In reality, you know, this, of course, the law doesn't speak in any way, shape, or form to pushing anybody or towards assisted suicide, as the term is there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a choice. It's an autonomy. It's an individual's decision.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody is doing fine in their current situation with mm-hmm. their disabilities, why would they want to opt toward end of life? Well, they wouldn't. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure I would totally agree with that.
Well, here was another talking point they
had.
Their
opinion.
Yeah, they said, so the whole movement's called Death with Dignity.
Death with Dignity, okay.
And they say, we don't need to die to have dignity. In a society that prizes physical ability and stigmatizes impairments, it's no surprise that previously able-bodied people may tend to equate disability with a loss of dignity. This reflects the prevalent but insulting societal judgment that people who deal with incontinence or other losses of bodily function are lacking dignity. People with disabilities are concerned that these psychosocial disability-related factors have become widely accepted as sufficient justification for assisted suicide. I think that's a pretty darn good point.
Yeah, however, again, it's nobody's saying any disability means you need to kill yourself or have somebody help you die. It's mm-hmm. not the point. The point is mm-hmm. anybody with a terminal illness
mm-hmm.
who is in pain or mm-hmm. on the path to death
mm-hmm.
would have a choice to end their life with the help of a physician if that's their choice and they're terminal. What their opinion just spoke to is not that case.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Well,
that would be my opinion.
Yeah, and that's okay. like I said, there's pros and cons to this law. We know that it was enacted in Oregon, the Hemlock Society. We know that it was enacted in Washington, and now California has it. California residents were going up to Oregon to be able to do mm-hmm. this. One of the things I did learn in my hospice stint was that even though it's legal, not many people take advantage of this law.
In other states? Is that what you're saying?
At all.
Uh-huh.
But it's like, it's there.
Yeah.
If it needs to be.
Yeah.
It's not enforced. It's there if it needs to be, but not a lot of people make use of it.
Yeah.
Comparatively. You have more people opting for palliative care and for hospice.
Yeah.
So that's another thing to throw out there.
And of course, anybody at any point along the way of in palliative care or hospice care could opt for the assisted death. Anywhere along the way.
Mm-hmm.
We had a caller call in and have a question. How would the medical condition of Parkinson's fit into this scenario of assisted death? And I would... May I answer that, Mary?
Please do.
I think I would say that Parkinson's in and of itself would not necessarily. However... I also would say that people with Parkinson's disease may indeed end up in a situation where the Parkinson's disease has debilitated them so much that they're unable to participate in life as they knew it in a way that they would feel appropriate for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that they're... In severe cases, as it goes on in time, they indeed may be getting closer and closer to death.
Mm-hmm.
And that with the help of their physician to help that patient and that patient's family in that determination of progression of their Parkinson's, you know, where are they in that progression of Parkinson's? Are they near death? Or has it inhibited their life in such a degree that it's not worth, they just don't want to live anymore? I think if that was the case, severity and towards the end, severe case, that indeed it would fit this scenario, could fit this scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Parkinson's and many other medical conditions that are progressive.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to remember the patient has to be alert and oriented.
The patient
has to make that determination. Caregivers can't make that determination for someone. Family can't make that determination for someone. Power of attorney can't make that decision for someone. The individual.
Not for this.
The individual has got to be able to do that.
And let's restate that. This law that we're discussing involves the patient having full ability to think and make decisions on their own, full ability, full cognitive ability.
Mm-hmm.
This is their decision.
Mm-hmm.
A whole different subject is if a person's in a vegetative state or in a near vegetative state or in a severe dementia where they are not able to adequately think for themselves, their cognitive function is gone from them.
Mm-hmm.
Then the family has possibly, and we hope,
mm-hmm.
Some family member has durable power of attorney for health care,
mm-hmm.
and can help determine the types of care that that their loved one should have from their point of view. It would not be assisted death, however.
Mm-mm.
Because the patient is not able to make that decision, and this bill we're talking about and the ability in the state of California to legally do that, the patient has to be fully cognitive, fully able to make that decision themselves.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the crux of the law. And so, as we say, case by case, you have to really see what's going on in each family situation and each patient situation.
We're going to take a little music break, and then we'll come back with Mary Kearns again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Dr. Logan, Ken Logan, and the Doctor's Inn. Today we're speaking with Mary Kearns, a reverend, a chaplain here in Chico. And the subject that we're discussing has to do with death and dignity related to death and the autonomy or ability for a person in a terminal situation to be able, in the state of California, to have a physician assist them in death. It's a difficult subject to think about.
Yeah.
And
it's pretty heavy.
And people have strong opinions. I think some people have strong opinions on either side of that fence. However, if we all, I would encourage us all to keep in mind this has to do with the individual person who is suffering from a terminal illness. In other words, an illness that is in the process of taking their life, and that they choose then, fully able, cognitively able to make their own decisions. They have to be able have to be of that brain function ability. If they make the decision to have a physician help them in their life, that's legal in the state of California now. Well, this discussion that we're having today, I recently, just as a family physician, I will say that within the last week, I had a patient who was essentially terminally ill because of a variety of a few medical conditions. Not an old person either. Probably around 40, and maybe a little less than that. And he had already lost one leg in because of his illness, and he was already on kidney dialysis. But what happened in the end was he had a large stroke. He had a blood vessel in his brain bleed. And so he was in the intensive care unit. And so this discussion of do we keep him on a ventilator, he was totally, at this point, after the stroke, he was his brain was unable to function adequately. In other words, he was comatose, not awake, and not appearing to be able, by testing, able to... his brain was not able to have him be awake in the future. But even if he had part of this discussion on whether or not to keep him on the machines has to do with the fact of even if, let's say the stroke was, his brain ability improved a little bit, well then he was already in a horrible medical breakdown in various areas of his various parts of his body were in dysfunction. And if his brain, even if he came back, was significantly worse functionally than it was before the stroke, then he would have that on top of all these other things. And his ability to, he was already in a situation where his ability to care for himself was deficient. And then, so, part of that had to go into the discussion with family. And then, of course, I did not make a decision, but a family member had the durable power of attorney for healthcare and was ready to make a decision. And the patient passed. I really don't know if he was taken off a ventilator and he passed after that or if he passed away while he was on a ventilator. I really don't know the end of that, but this discussion of quality of life and what the patient would want in discussing it with a family was fresh in my mind. I mentioned there a second ago durable power of attorney for healthcare, and you mentioned earlier advanced directives, and I wanna put a advice out to the listeners. For all of us, no matter our age or health, I think I really do think it's a wise idea or a good idea to think about this subject of what we would want in our lives if we were terminally ill or if we had a bad heart attack or stroke or bad auto accident or whatever, and we were in a significantly debilitated state or terminal state, what our ideas would be. In other words, would we have any specific desires for aggressiveness of care to keep us alive or not?
Mm-hmm.
And if we had a cardiac arrest or our heart stopped, would we want cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, to bring us back?
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of decisions about end of life with other medical conditions potentially involved is something that we all can think about mm-hmm. while we are healthy.
And having that conversation and beginning that conversation, it's territory that no one really wants to go to. But
yeah.
I belong to a group here in town. Acronym is ALSED, and it's the Alliance for Support and Education on Death and Dying.
Hmm.
And we are a group of people who are committed to educating Chico and our county and just saying, start the conversation. Make sure you have that advance directive done. Make sure that there is durable power of attorney. Make sure your health care wishes are in writing.
Good.
So that should an event happen, your family, who will be traumatized by
yes.
aforementioned event,
yes.
doesn't have to make that decision. You made it for them.
Yeah.
Which alleviates so much more stress. You're just following, hey, this is what Dad wanted, or hey, this is what Mom wanted. And it makes so much sense.
It does make sense to do it ahead of time. I'm telling you, the time that isn't appropriate, or it's just horrible to be doing it, all that decision-making from the ground up mm-hmm. is not when the event has happened.
Or the day after, or the
yeah.
night before the surgery, like
yeah.
what happened with my dad.
Oh, yeah,
he filled
right.
out his advance directive the night before his quadruple bypass.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave all the power to the doctor.
Mm.
And the doctor just kept treating aggressively. And my dad stayed in the hospital for 4 months and died
mm.
in a ventilator unit in Portland,
mm-hmm.
Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And I look back on that with hindsight, and I start saying to myself, you know what? This is how I'm filling out my advance directive. This
yeah.
is what I want. I'm not going to have a doctor say, well, I'm going to keep treating this aggressively.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm focused on that quality of life, that end of life for me.
You know, that story you just gave about your father, it reminds me of my uncle many, many, many years ago, before many of us were even talking about death issues.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and he did the same thing, lived for, I don't mm-hmm. know, 2 or 3 months on a ventilator and then died
mm-hmm.
here in this city.
Yeah. You know, death in the hospital doesn't have to be sad. Death in the hospital
yeah.
can be
yeah.
a beautiful
yeah.
and peaceful
yeah.
thing. And as a chaplain, I have seen dozens of events like that. And I have good stories to share on that, too, when the family and the husband and everyone's on board and they're like, okay, we realize continuing treatment here is actually more torture than it
mm-hmm.
is relief,
mm-hmm.
and we're here to ease help. That transition and help. And they are beautiful and peaceful, and the family feels complete, and there's good closure, healthy crying, healthy tears, and lots of love. And
yeah.
that can happen in an ICU, too.
It can. And it can. And remembering that death is part of our life
mm-hmm.
for all of us. It's
mm-hmm.
the circle of life. It's part of what we all will go through. Mary Kearns, I thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
It's potential to... As a matter of fact, your husband, Jesse Kearns, has been on the show before, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, thinking, hey, how can we get you both on a show? That'd be great.
I would love to do something on bereavement care, because there's a whole lot to talk about that, too. So,
thank you again. Hey, can you tell me one more time, if someone was interested in the death and dying group, tell me the name of the group again.
Our acronym is ALSED, and it's the Alliance for Support and Education on Death and Dying.
And how could a listener get in touch with you about that?
You can email me at Mac and Jess, MAKN as in Nancy, JESS at Comcast.net, and I can link you up with the rest of the group and get you hooked into some of our educational events.
Great. I'm thinking of a book on death and dying.
Mm-hmm.
That's, what, 40, 50 years old, that book?
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading that many, many, many years ago.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Mary Kearns. Thanks very again.
Thank you, guys.
And now we're going to have a community health update from Dr. Mark Lundberg, our Butte County Health Officer. Here, Dr. Lundberg, are you on the air?
Dr. Logan, I am. Can you hear me there?
I can hear you, and it's good to hear you.
Great segment by Mary there. That was wonderful, and what compassionate topic there to help people die with dignity. That's great.
Great. Thank you for saying.
And I would. I don't know. I didn't catch the whole show, but I remember how helpful hospice is really in helping people die. Gracefully and with family, and how that my own family, we experienced that with my dad, how nice that could be to have their help with that.
Yeah, and hospice being something, for the listeners who are not aware, that is actually is a function of home health nurses at a patient's home, usually. I mean, that's the usual hospice situation, so it's available to all of us in our end-of-life situations in our home to help us through at the end of our lives. Yeah.
You know, Dr. Logan, sort of on the lighter note, I know it's a very serious topic. On a lighter note, I've had a special advanced directive, a very unique advanced directive that I have put into, sort of told my family about, and that is, I've been at the county for 20 years and built up a huge amount of sick leave, unused sick leave. I said, if I ever get to be brain dead, I said, and I'm on a ventilator, I would recommend you keep me alive until you use up all my sick leave and pull the plug. Do you think that's a very good idea? That's kind of a unique advanced directive there.
I think that's between you and your family, and what I think my opinion is whatever works for you and your family.
I think that's pretty. Sorry for that bad little highlight there.
What else is going on, Dr. Lundberg?
Well, I would tell you that one thing that that actually your introduction to me today is not exactly correct any longer.
Oh.
If you could believe this, after over 20 years working in the health department, and I'm the health officer for more than those 20 years, I actually have taken another job in the county.
Huh.
And it happened fast. It happened really fast.
Wow.
And I've moved over to the behavioral health department.
Oh.
And I am working in the substance use disorder unit.
Huh.
Helping people with medical assisted treatment or medical assisted therapy to help them with their substance use.
Great.
You know, one of the things that I started doing in the health department, we recognize that we have an opioid problem in Butte County. By the way, many of your readers probably, your listeners have probably seen the series that the Enterprise Record is doing right now, I think a 7 or 8 part series, talking about opioid addiction in Butte County. And in at least two of the series, they talk about there are some patients that have addictions, and they have talked about how challenging it has been to get off of opiates.
Mm-hmm.
Opiates are things like Norco or heroin or OxyContin.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about a medicine called Suboxone
that
helped them make that transition off of these drugs and into more freedom in their life and more directed therapy and more directed counseling.
Suboxone.
Suboxone is the name of the medicine. It is a medicine that has some characteristics, definitely characteristics of an opiate. So it does sort of help replace the opiate that we're on, but it also has characteristics that help them stay sober and not give them euphoria, but help them be feeling normal.
And that's a medication by prescription that is not able to be prescribed by all physicians. Is that correct?
That's right. You have to have some special permission by the Drug Enforcement Agency of our federal government to be able to prescribe the medicine. You have to take some special training. And in our community, there's a very limited number of people are doing that. And so about 7 years ago, the health department, we said, we got to help poor people get access to this medicine. There was a lot of, there were some doctors doing it, but there were limited access to the medicine. And this is an alternative to methadone. Maybe your listeners mm-hmm. will know that methadone is a kind of a medicine being used also for treatment, medical assisted treatment of opiate addiction. And in Chico, we have a methadone clinic. To use methadone, you have to be a federally qualified or federally licensed clinic. So there are very few of them. In fact, Chico is the furthest north, I think, in California. So we have methadone. This is sort of an alternative, this is a medicine that you can be a private doctor or a licensed physician. You can be trained to do that. So I started doing that about 7 years ago, and I tell you, one of the most rewarding areas of work I've ever done.
Oh.
And so when this opportunity arose, when the behavioral health who really want to respond, I was very limited. I only did it one day a week.
Mm-hmm.
When they had a position available and open for a full-time position to work in this area,
mm-hmm.
it really has become one of my loves and one of my rewarding thing I've done in my mm-hmm. profession. So I took mm-hmm. the position, and so mm-hmm. I've been only doing it about 2 weeks now, two and a half weeks. I am the interim health officer until they find a replacement for me, and then mm-hmm. I stay with the health department and help them out a couple days a week.
Mm-hmm.
But, that will be my new position at the behavioral health department. I'm very excited about it.
Kind of give me, as a physician here in town, as me being a family physician here in town, can you give the me and the listeners, the community, a little heads up on how that will look as far as how do patients get into this treatment that's going to be available through the county, et cetera? What's the practical side of this?
I know that one thing, probably a lot of your listeners know, they probably know personally, they know people in their lives that have had a problem in this area.
Mm-hmm. It is with opiates.
It is with opiates. It's, mm-hmm. You know, just even this week, I'll just describe one of the patients I saw. She had a C-section, and after the C-section, she'd never been on opiates before that C-section.
Mm-hmm.
And after the C-section, she started using regular Norco.
Mm-hmm.
And she did purposely start kind of asking for more and more from the doctor, more than she probably needed for pain control
mm-hmm.
after that C-section. And then it just sort of spiraled out of control after the doctor had to cut her off. Then she had withdrawal. Withdrawal can be terribly uncomfortable for patients.
Mm-hmm.
And then they look for alternatives on the street many times.
Mm-hmm.
So this particular patient looked for alternatives and eventually found a medicine called heroin. It's a very powerful opiate, and a replacement for things like Norco or OxyContin. And then they were really stuck, because when you start using heroin, it's so addicting, it's so difficult for people to get off.
Mm-hmm.
And the other just example, I'm sure this is similar to some of your listeners, heard a patient who hurt his ankle, and a friend thought they were doing them some favor, said, "Hey, I have some Norco at home. Let me give you some Norco stash I have." And that little bit of a little offering that they gave patient just spiraled into an addiction.
Hmm.
And you know, these people that I meet, many of them, they haven't lost everything yet. You know,
mm-hmm.
you think of a heroin addict, someone that's lost everything, they're on the street.
Mm-hmm.
But there's people that have opiate addictions that they have not all lost everything. They're still working full time,
mm-hmm.
they still have children, they still have families,
mm-hmm.
but they are stuck in an addiction that they have to use medicine every day they buy on the street to feel
mm-hmm.
normal.
Mm-hmm.
So the place I'm working now, well, it's probably a little bit limiting, because we are trying to help the poor also. There are places for people who have insurance to go in this community. We know a number of doctors that have a Suboxone clinics.
Mm-hmm.
One of the doctors I use as a reference is Dr. Brandon Stark. He has a practice in Chico.
Stark,
S-T-A-R-K. Other doctors, too.
S-T-A-R-K, okay.
Mm-hmm. But our practice will be, place I'm working right now will be mainly for people that are poor, that have Medi-Cal,
mm-hmm.
and trying to help give them access to this medicine and help get them counseling. The other thing I got to mm-hmm. say is that the medicine itself does not heal you. We really insist that people get counseling to get insight into the problem, to help make them strong and help them move forward in their lives, because many of these people have gotten really stuck in a lot of ruts, more than just their opiate addiction. There's been coping mechanisms that are very dysfunctional that they've had with their families, with their friends, with their community. And they really need to unravel some of that and need counselors to help them reunify, maybe reconcile, find other ways to deal with stress.
Absolutely.
That are more productive.
So counseling a distinct part of this process of coming, treating.
Yeah, it's required. It's just the medicine alone, yeah, it helps people, but it doesn't get to some of the root problems that will help them break out of some bad habits and get them into a place where we can get them off the medicine. We always want a picture of getting them off this medicine.
Right. So in your work now on into the future, it's through Butte County Behavioral Health, and a person with an opiate addiction who has Medi-Cal or the Medi-Cal managed care has that option, that availability of
right.
you and your department's work.
That's
at
right.
the Butte County Behavioral Health. Okay,
right.
Very good. And they could connect there on, is it on Rio Lindo Avenue?
Right. That's where our clinic is right now. I'm really seeing some really great patients, very courageous patients, patients that really inspire me because they're really trying to get their lives back.
Gotcha. Well, Dr. Lundberg, again, thank you so much for your information. And will you be able to be with us again in a month, the third Thursday of the month?
I don't think a final replacement for me in the health department just so fast. So
well,
I'll probably bring a little bit of both to you next time.
Well,
it's always been a pleasure to work with you, Dr.
Well, Dr. Lundberg, you're not getting away from me this easy. Nice try.
That's good.
Okay, thanks a lot, right. Dr. Lundberg.
So nice to talk with you there. Best to you all.
Thank you. And thanks to Mary Kearns, Reverend and Chaplain here in Chico, talking with us today about dying with dignity. And thanks to Ray Lager, the engineer here at the Doctor's Inn, the third Thursday of each month. And also, thanks to you, the listeners, who help this show and all KZFR shows be possible by your generous contributions and by an underwriter named Madsen Properties, specializing in professional management of rental property in Chico, Oroville, Paradise, and Magalia. Alicia Madsen is a licensed broker specializing in single and multi-unit property. From move-in to move-out, Alicia can make your investment property endeavor a positive and profitable experience. For more information and to view available rental properties, visit Madsen, and that's Madsen. So MadsenPropertyManagement.com or call 570-6192. And the opinions voiced on this show do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. Stay tuned for Beatle Nation. See you in a month. Bye. I don't